Welcome to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, alongside my co-host, Matt Miller.
Every business day, we bring you interviews from CEOs, market pros, and Bloomberg experts, along with essential market-moving news.
Find the Bloomberg Markets Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts and at Bloomberg.com/podcast.
Well, a lot of folks in this market, you know, they've been waiting for, you know, a pullback, a 5, 7, 10% pullback as part of a healthy part of this market. Maybe saying, you know, I'll get in at that point. Our next guest says, don't worry about time in the market. If you have the time horizon, stay long. David Katz, Chief Investment Officer for Matrix Asset Advisors, joins us. So, David, I know you guys did a survey, you know, taking a look at buying the dips, if you will. What did your survey kind of show you guys?
So basically, we looked at the period of 1993 to this summer, and over that 28.5-year period, stocks were up about 10.4%. Within that, you had 34 corrections of 5% or more. So the moral of the story is the stock market's going to correct. You basically want to ride the ups and the downs, and that's the best way to make money. The other thing that's pretty interesting is the recoveries occur much faster than anybody imagines or believes is possible or likely. So 31 of those 34 corrections were between 5 and 20%, and the average recovery time was 2.2 months. So that means the market sells off pretty quickly and then bounces back pretty quickly. And our best advice is buy the dip. We've already had a 5% correction. We think it's a good time to be putting money to work. We think the market recovery is going to be much quicker than anybody thinks possible.
I'm wondering what you think the role of the retail trader is in all of this, because the narrative for so long has been that it is the small-time individual investor that's really super bullish that has been coming in and buying these dips with such vigor. And there are signs that that kind of activity is starting to wane. Does that mean buy the dip is also going to?
We don't think so. Again, this study goes back to 1993, so this is a long time, and there are always different forces at different points in time. We think one of the biggest drivers of the stock recovery this time is there's a tremendous amount of liquidity out there. Interest rates are still very low. People are looking places to put their money, which means that on a dip, money is going to likely come into the market.
All right, so where are you at Matrix Advisors kind of allocating your capital these days? There's a lot of economic concern growing out there, you know, whether it be supply chain challenges, margin pressures, inflation challenges. We've got some uncertainty in Washington, D.C. Where do you guys see the opportunities?
So we think if you look at the market on a longer term basis, you can look through a lot of these uncertainties. Washington is dysfunctional and unfortunately has been dysfunctional for the last 20 or 30 years, if not longer. Ultimately, they're going to get their act together, but it's just going to be at the last minute, and there's going to be a lot of noise along the way. In terms of the supply disruptions, we think that's going to hit a lot of companies in this quarter's earnings. Right now, the market is penalizing those companies pretty fiercely. We think that one or two things. You want to try to buy companies that are not going to be impacted by that, or you want to buy companies in the aftermath of having a problem. So stock that we think is a great opportunity right here is Federal Express. They are a good long-term secular growth story as more people are shopping online. They're shipping more packages. Global economy's picking up. Very good for them. They had a modestly disappointing quarter, and it was driven by logistics, not being able to get enough employees, and inflation. As a result, the stock is sold off from 320 to 225. We think it's a great entry point right here if you can look beyond the short-term uncertainty.
But what happens if some of those uncertainties and or supply side pressures prove to be more persistent? How long can they last while you still think that those are quote unquote short term?
Well, in terms of Federal Express, the stock's at 11 times earnings. So, you know, if it takes 6 months to turn around or 9 months, we are less concerned because we know the stock's going to be 30 or 40% higher. In terms of corporate America, we think that inflation has picked up. You're going to see it more this quarter. We think it's starting to tame in certain areas that had it first, like the consumer product companies. We were talking about inflation 6, 9 months ago. Now that seems to be having peaked and coming down slowly. We think there are going to be supply disruptions. We think there are going to be chip shortages, but the economy is very strong. Demand is robust. We think we're going to get through this. And the key is find good businesses that are going to do well, you know, through the cycle. So Cisco, which is a technology company, they're having supply disruptions. They're having to pay more for their chips. but they have great demand and they're still earning a lot of money. It's at a great price and it's paying you a good yield while you wait. So we think as long as you're not looking for really healthy, sharp momentum right now, you're able to buy good businesses that are going to get through this. And the time to buy them is when the stock has been discounted, assuming that the problem lasts forever, and it's not going to.
20 seconds, David. Facebook, regulatory risk. What's your concern, if any?
We think Facebook is a bad corporate citizen. There is regulatory risk. However, at $330, we think the stock is a very good buying opportunity. If you don't mind holding a company where you're a little bit less enamored with management, they have an addictive product. That's part of the problem. The good part is it's an addictive product, and as a result, their advertising is going to grow for years to come. So we think it's a good long-term investment, but you have to understand you're not buying the best management team in terms of ethics out there.
David Katz, Chief Investment Officer, Matrix Asset Advisors. Interesting call there on Facebook. Just go where the money is, and that's certainly where the money is going from an advertising perspective. David Katz, Matrix Advisors. We're going to have more coming up. This is Bloomberg. All right, Tom Keene's not here, so we can talk about Bitcoin. $50,000 per coin. Volatility, okay. The question is, where does this thing go? And it is big, big news here at Bloomberg News Crypto, because we just recently hired a managing editor for crypto. That tells me, I was like, oh boy, we are all in following this asset class, as we should be. Stacey Marie Ishmael, managing editor for crypto for Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone here. Stacey Marie, again, Bitcoin at 50,000, it's a nice round number. It's a level. What do you take away from it?
Well, it certainly is a nice round number and a level, but you know, one of the things that's been interesting about the moves, you know, we're really paying attention to kind of the trend over the past few months, right? So we're looking at prices that have gone up more than 60% since hitting lows in July, and of course the high in April in the 60s of thousands. One of the pieces of news that came out in the past couple of days, which, you know, folks in the market say has been really driving some of this enthusiasm, is a report from Bank of America. They've initiated coverage, they're hiring a crypto team, and the phrase that they used in the research notes was that Bitcoin is too large to ignore. And various market participants who are enthusiastic at the best of times have really taken this as a sign that this is a currency and asset class that is really around to stay. And the hope of a lot of these market participants is that it's going to continue to go up for sure.
Well, how do technicals maybe help us figure out if indeed the trajectory from here is higher? I feel like that's all you really can rely on when it comes to crypto, because, you know, there's not that many fundamentals.
Well, I think there are a few technical conditions that folks are looking at. One is 52,900, which is a minor resistance number that some folks are paying attention to. And the suspicion is that if there is, you know, if we hit above that number, then we're looking to potentially have a breakout, which might see us hit those $65,000 prices again.
So, Stacey Marie, a lot of folks, and even some folks I think at the big New York banks, are still not buying into this crypto thingamajig. You know, what do you think is the next event that needs to happen for legitimacy for those folks that are kind of naysayers? Is it something like a G20 country adopting Bitcoin in some way? What do you think are the next big milestones for this space?
Well, I think one of the things that I've really been listening to, you know, here at Bloomberg, we've had a lot of folks on TV and at our events and on radio, of course, talking about what it would take for them to either be personally or professionally invested in crypto. And we had Ken Griffin say just yesterday that whatever his initial crypto skepticisms and his longstanding crypto skepticisms, actually, he would be more interested from a Citadel perspective if there was more clarity around regulation. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly been something I've heard echoed by other market participants. You mentioned having kind of a G20 country take this seriously. Obviously, folks are looking at the experiment in El Salvador with making Bitcoin acceptable as legal tender, as, you know, perhaps something that other countries might follow. Mm-hmm. I think there's a tremendous amount of potential institutional interest in what would happen if Bitcoin ETFs actually
arrive. I was just about to say, we think it's, I mean, the Gary Gensler SEC, I feel like, remains a mystery on its crypto policy. It seems like it's not as friendly as people maybe thought initially. Do we have any kind of idea when and if we will actually get some kind of Bitcoin ETF approved?
Well, I think far be it for me to speculate, but I would say that market participants are optimistic that ETFs, at least one, and you know, per your point about Gensler, that it would likely be a futures-backed ETF. I think there is a, there, you know, folks are predicting that there will be at least one in the market by the end of the year.
It's interesting. I see one of the top analysts on all of Wall Street, Jessica Reif Ehrlich, who's been a number top-rated media analyst for probably 30 years on Wall Street at Merrill Lynch and now Bank of America Merrill Lynch. She is now a strategist focusing on crypto. So there's another example of a big bank saying we're putting some research, we're putting some assets, some resources behind this asset class. Are we starting to see that more and more, Stacey Marie, as you think about the buy side, the sell side, the whole kind of Wall Street support of crypto? Are you seeing what's the level of engagement and resources that you think are being allocated to this asset class?
Well, to your point, there are a couple of ways that we are trying to keep an eye on this, right? One is just the sheer volume of crypto mentions and existing research notes from different teams. Crypto is something that touches lots of different asset classes. And so you have, you know, our own analysts and strategists at BI, for example, will regularly contextualize this in terms of like what's happening with gold and how is that affecting Bitcoin. So we are really paying attention to how folks with that macro perspective are considering or mentioning crypto or even in some cases, other coins. That's one. The second is hiring. So both at the Wall Street level and on the buy side, on the sell side, but also, you know, we're looking at like pension funds who are saying we might be interested in understanding how Bitcoin would make sense in our portfolio. U.S. Bank came out with a statement today saying that they are going to start offering custodial services for cryptocurrencies. And so like that's kind of the level of institutional normalization that we're paying attention to in addition to just, you know, pure fund flows.
Yeah, it's just extraordinary to kind of watch and study the growth of this market. It's really fascinating. Stacey Marie Ishmael, she's a managing editor covering all things crypto for Bloomberg. Let's call her our crypto czar, if you will.
We could not.
This is radio. We're trying to make the, you know, theater of the mind. All right, so she joins us from Bloomberg News. Thanks so much, Stacey. We really appreciate it. Well, big tech has increasingly come under I think the attention of Washington lawmakers, regulators, and no company, it seems, more so than Facebook. And Facebook recently had a whistleblower speak out against some of the harms that the company perpetuates. The former employee, Frances Haugen, went on 60 Minutes this past weekend, speaking today, testifying at a Senate hearing on kids' safety. So some big issues for Facebook. And then I looked down at the stock. It's up 20% year to date, a little bit off of its all-time high. So it doesn't seem to be that big of an issue, at least for the stock price. Naomi Nix, corporate influence reporter for Bloomberg News, joins us on the phone from Washington. So Naomi, boy, it just seems like there's lots of fundamental problems overhanging Facebook. How do you think this plays out? Is this a big problem for the company?
It could be. Now, look, on the one hand, Facebook has weathered a number of political crises in the past. It was just, you know, 3 years ago when it was handling Cambridge Analytica, and there was a lot of blowback for the company. But ultimately, it still built this very powerful, very profitable advertising behemoth. And it actually, you know, Washington never passed a national privacy law to address that breach. We're again in one of those kinds of major crisis moments where Facebook is grappling with criticism from lawmakers and advocates that it's been hiding its internal research showing some of the negative effects of its platform. And so the question is, will Washington act? Will Facebook be forced to change its ways? I think that's still an open question.
Well, and the whole kind of basis of this testimony from the whistleblower centers around the idea that the company prioritized profits over people. How much can regulators really fault a company for prioritizing profit? Isn't that what companies do?
That's exactly right. But remember, that refrain from the whistleblower, she was really talking about specific areas and specific types of practices that the company was engaging in which she saw that to be the case. So, for instance, one of the revelations that came from the documents was that Facebook had essentially been making some very powerful celebrities and politicians and journalists essentially immune from their content enforcement decisions. And they had previously said, oh, that just affects a small number of users, when in fact that group that receives a form of immunity or difference in treatment numbers in the millions. Mm. You know, there were revelations about kind of, you know, Facebook often deflected to conflicting mix of outside studies about the mental health impact of Instagram on its youngest users, when in fact it actually knew far more, that particularly for some vulnerable teens who are already feeling bad about their bodies, that Instagram has a very negative role in their lives. And so, like, those are specific kind of issues that regulators could try to get at. There have been some proposals in this today's hearing around, you know, enhancing privacy protections or limiting targeted advertising or paring back a legal shield known as Section 230 mm-hmm. that protects tech companies.
Yeah, we've heard that one floated a few times before.
So, Naomi, I've even heard lawmakers equate Facebook with big tobacco, i.e. they had internal information knowing that their product had negative effects, yet they withheld it and kept promoting their product. Is that taking it too far, do you think?
I'm not sure if it is taking it too far. There's certainly some parallels. So for decades, right, big tobacco companies essentially argued that, well, the research linking cigarettes to having cancerous effects or to being addictive is a little bit mixed, and more research is needed. Facebook, when it came to when it was facing questions around what, you know, is social media good for young kids, often also deflected to outside research, which was conflicting. But in fact, Facebook is the organization that's best positioned to conduct the most thorough research on this topic. And they had a lot more concrete evidence that for some kids, it is actually doesn't play a good role in their lives. And so, you know, the question is, will Congress bring Facebook to account in the same way that government brought big tobacco companies to account? I don't know.
Well, and the question is how difficult bringing them to account really is, because, I mean, obviously it's not just the whistleblower that has given Facebook a headache over the last couple of days. They had a huge outage yesterday, and me and everybody I know basically ceased to function because Instagram wasn't working, WhatsApp wasn't working. So that just goes to show you how massive the influence of this company is and the amount of people it reaches. How do you even go about reining in a company that large?
Well, it's a good question, right? Because any laws that Congress would try to pass would likely not just affect Facebook, right? It would affect other tech platforms who maybe are doing similar things but don't have similar problems. And so getting that legislation right in a way that's precise would be tricky. I think one area of vulnerability that Facebook is facing is on the antitrust front. It's obviously facing some critiques from the Federal Trade Commission and states on that level, you know, going as far as seeking to unwind Facebook from its Instagram and WhatsApp acquisitions. That would have a very sort of catastrophic effect on the company's future. But I think regulating these areas get really tricky, and that's part of the reason why we haven't seen some progress.
Naomi, how well do you think, or how is Facebook performing in terms of defending itself? I mean, Mark Zuckerberg, the face of Facebook, is that a good thing? How do you think the company's doing in dealing with all these issues?
Facebook has really launched an aggressive defense campaign against some of the allegations. It went as far as to release a point-by-point rebuttal to the Wall Street Journal's reporting and characterization of its own research. It said the newspaper was downplaying some of the evidence that shows that social media, and particularly its own social networks, play a positive role in teenagers' lives. It has, you know, we've seen Nick Clegg, you know, participate in an interview with Mike Allen. We've seen the company went as far as to release additional slides to show context to the Wall Street Journal's reporting. The Wall Street Journal then responded and released even more slides.
Right.
And so they're definitely aggressive, and there's a good reason for that. They need to be able to attract young users to remain competitive.
All right, Naomi, thank you so much for joining us. Really, really good to get your perspective and your reporting. Naomi Nix, corporate influence reporter for Bloomberg News on the phone from Washington, D.C. Looking at my BCOM, Bloomberg Commodities Index chart for the trailing 12 months, boy, it is up and to the right in a big way, showing that commodity inflation out there. Let's check in with Will Rind. He's founder and CEO of Granite Shares. They have about $1.5 billion in assets under management. So, Bill, as we step back and take a 30,000-foot view of what a lot of folks are concerned about, which is inflation in this economy sparked in part by rising commodity prices. How are you viewing the commodity asset class, if you will? What's really driving it here?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that now we live in a complicated world where the interconnectedness of not just the commodity markets but global markets more broadly means that there's not one sort of simple answer to what we're experiencing at the moment. Part of it is the COVID recovery. Part of it is the fact that we have a huge amount of demand right now, but we don't have the supplies to meet that demand. Part of it also, due to COVID, is the fact that, in terms of the supply chain, we have still a lot of restrictions in place around moving goods, et cetera, around the world due to COVID. And then we have also factors such as, the transition to renewable energy, the decarbonization efforts that major economies are taking. And, some of that, particularly relevant to Europe at the moment, has meant that we perhaps jumped a little bit too quickly to a scenario whereby we don't now have enough, energy to meet these immediate needs, and hence the prices are skyrocketing. You have the China effect as well, in terms of what's going on in the Chinese economy, very important, always to global commodity prices. But I think that we're looking at a situation now where rising commodity prices across the board, it's largely due to the fact that we have more demand than we have supply at the moment.
Yeah, the whole renewable energy, green energy transition is really interesting when we think about the current power crisis, because you have a lot of investment in new renewable energy sources, wind, solar, and you're seeing a pullback in investment of those more legacy energy sources like coal and oil, and that leaves you obviously with this huge gap we're seeing. And storage, of course, is a big problem. When you're thinking about the impact of the green energy transition and the materials that are required for it, how does that kind of affect your outlook for commodities if oil and gas is continuing to be underinvested in and utilized less versus clean energy?
Well, again, that's a great point, because there's been woeful underinvestment in the commodity sector for many, many years. I mean, certainly since 2014, you can argue sort of at the bottom of the last kind of bear market, that capital expenditure or CapEx, just more broadly, has been really laughable in the sector. And so that's now kind of compounding these issues where, on the one hand, we're saying we want to decarbonize as a global economy. We want to transition to green energy or renewable energy. But I think what's perhaps underappreciated is the amount of commodities that we need, the amount of materials we need to do that. Now, albeit they're different to the hydrocarbons that are making the headlines today, i.e. oil, natural gas, et cetera. But certainly the amount of materials we need, particularly the metals, copper, aluminum, et cetera, those are all metals that we greatly need, and we just don't have those resources at the moment. We're going to need a huge amount of investment to get that production up.
All right, so I guess the question for many people is timing here. Is this bout of commodity inflation transitory, as the Federal Reserve continues to believe, or is it something maybe a little bit more pronounced given all of the variables, whether it's supply chain and others, that we have to deal with?
I mean, my view is that I think that this is, I mean, I guess it goes back to what's the definition of transitory. The longer that we have 5% plus inflation, the more difficult it is to say that it's transitory. or indeed the transitory, becomes longer and longer. And so I think that we're going to see inflation higher or at elevated levels for quite some time. You know, my concern, I guess, at the moment is that this all feels a little bit like the 1970s, where those who remember that around then we had an oil crisis, which is, you know, in some respects analogous to what's going on at the moment, an energy crisis followed by a recession, but inflation that, you know, ended up at the end of that decade with, you know, certainly the gold price, among other things, at an all-time high.
Right.
And so I think that there's some lessons potentially in that period to what's potentially going on today. But, you know, some of these issues, whether it be the COVID situation around commodities at the moment, I mean, you can make an argument that those can start to ease and those will get better. But my concern is more the structural imbalances that we have due to the woeful lack of capex in the sector. And those are just some things that you just can't fix overnight. These are not going to happen. They're not short turnarounds. And so I think we could be in an environment where, you know, these commodity prices, you know, remain elevated for some time.
Hey, Will, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate getting your thoughts here. Again, commodities really in focus. The impact on inflationary pressures on the economy really coming into focus, and we're likely going to see more evidence of that as we come into earnings season. Will Ryan, he's the founder and CEO of Granite Shares, about $1.5 billion in assets under management located in New York City. And again, as we come up with earnings starting in earnest next week, it'll be interesting to see how companies frame this inflation and its impact on their operations and on their guidance, more importantly. Will that be an issue and to what extent? So we'll certainly be on the lookout for that.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Matt Miller. I'm on Twitter at MattMiller1973.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide at Bloomberg Radio.